think about the last time you watched, like, a nature documentary. Or really, just think about how the natural world is usually presented to us visually in, well, basically any format.
Oh, yeah, there is this overwhelming expectation of a bloody battlefield.
Exactly. I mean, we want the great white shark breaching the surface with a seal in its jaws, right? We want that high definition, slow motion shot of the cheetah taking down a gazelle.
Right.
Even when the cameras zoom all the way down to the microscopic level, they show us ants engaged in this brutal all-out war for territory.
Because we are culturally conditioned to expect adrenaline. It's, you know, everything we consume prioritizes survival of the fittest,
Yeah.
high-stakes climax, constant, undeniable
You're
conflict.
obsessed with it.
We are. If there isn't life or death drama happening on the screen or, you know, splashed across a canvas, we somehow feel like nature's being boring. We've essentially placed extreme movement and noise on a pedestal.
Yeah, we are entirely hooked on a hyperactive visual narrative. And that expectation, that thirst for conflict, is exactly why the source material we're plunging into for today's deep dive is just so brilliantly unexpected.
Completely unexpected.
Because we are not looking at a chaotic documentary of the savannah today. We're actually focusing on a 15 by 22 inch digital artwork. It was created in July 2023 by the contemporary artist Jairo Duque, and it's simply titled Vida.
And on its surface, I mean, it is a quiet, highly minimalist image of a hummingbird and a bee.
Very simple.
Exactly. But beneath that accessible aesthetic layer, it operates as this radical ethical manifesto on coexistence. And when you look directly at the artist's personal logbooks, his technical files, and his private curatorial notes, you realize this piece is actively dismantling our obsession with conflict.
And for you listening, whether you're an art student trying to figure out how to balance raw technique with actual emotion, or really just a creative person looking to apply a, you know, less is more philosophy to whatever you do at work or in your daily projects, Duke's method here is a masterclass in visual communication.
It really is. And to understand how this piece challenges that obsession with noise, we first have to visualize the artwork itself, which the artist catalogs in his files as Vida1.jpg.
Right, so let's paint the picture for you. The background of this piece is a soft, blurred mosaic of green tones. There are no hard edges anywhere in the background. It's just an almost formless wash of color.
Yeah, it's very hazy.
And in the very center, rendered with this incredibly magnetic level of detail, is a tiny hummingbird.
It's vibrant, practically glowing, really. And the bird is resting on a geometric structure, which is a brightly colored, intensely red feeder.
But the detail that completely breaks your brain, both biologically and visually, is right at the top of the composition, resting directly on the crown of the hummingbird's head, sitting there with absolute impossible placidity, is a bee.
It looks completely bucolic, you know, almost like a serene fable. And at first glance, you might just categorize it as a pretty nature illustration.
Yeah, just a nice drawing.
Exactly. But once you cross-reference the image with Duke's private diaries, however,
Yeah.
you discover that every single pixel of this aesthetic is highly calculated. And the strategy behind it actually starts with the physical location where the piece was born.
Yeah, according to the technical files, this piece was created in Duke's studio in Whittier, California. And he notes this geographic location with immense specificity in his logs.
Which is so important because that location provides crucial context. California, particularly the sprawling area surrounding the entertainment industry, is a hyperactive epicenter.
Oh,
It's
totally.
this cultural machine that devours images by the second. It's endlessly obsessed with fleeting trends and massive, unavoidable visual noise.
Okay, let me just jump in with an analogy here because setting up a studio to paint something this profoundly quiet in Whittier, California, feels a bit like setting up a sensory deprivation tank in the middle of a heavy metal rock concert.
That is exactly what it is.
Right. So is that geographical isolation essentially functioning as a medium for the artwork just as much as the digital paint itself?
Oh, absolutely. If
Yeah.
we connect this to the bigger picture, the studio acts as a sanctuary of cultivated quiet. The environment forces the artist to physically shut out the surrounding metropolis.
Wow.
And so the artwork then becomes a sponge for that cultivated silence. It carries the literal atmospheric quiet of its birthplace. And then he essentially packaged that silence into a digital file and shipped it off to be exhibited at the Artboxy Nicoletta Gallery in May 2024.
Which is in Berlin, another massive, noisy, hyperkinetic metropolis. He takes the silence of a Whittier sanctuary and drops it right into the chaos of the European art scene.
Yeah, and translating that physical silence into a visual medium that can survive a loud gallery requires a very specific technical approach. In the medium section of his notes, Duke lists digital art, Procreate software, reference image taken from the web.
Wait, I have to stop you there, because there is a massive lingering stigma attached to digital art.
Oh, for sure.
A lot of people still assume that using software means you just hit a magic print button,
yep,
or that you're just tracing a photograph on an iPad. And honestly, with a tool like Procreate, you have the ability to zoom in 1,000% and map out every single pixel of a reference photo.
Right.
Doesn't that immense power just invite an artist to obsess over hyper detail? Like, why wouldn't he just trace it and make it perfect?
That's a great question, because people often assume the software does the heavy lifting. But a program like Procreate requires the exact same pressure, tilt, and pulse of the human hand as a physical brush.
Okay.
You are still starting with a blank digital canvas. And regarding his use of an internet reference photo, Duke doesn't trace it. He uses a process he explicitly calls distilling.
Distilling. Like boiling down a complex liquid to get the essential extract.
Precisely. When you pull a raw photo from the internet, you inherit massive amounts of chaotic data.
Yeah.
You get light bouncing unpredictably off leaves. You get optical flaws from the camera lens.
Background clutter.
Exactly. Background clutter that adds absolutely nothing to the core narrative. If he just copied all of that, he'd be acting like a biological printer. Instead, he filters that raw data. He analyzes the visual noise and decides what stays and what gets permanently eliminated.
His notes offer some incredibly actionable advice for art students and, really, anyone who makes things. He writes about intentionally avoiding hyperrealism. It must take immense discipline to have a tool where you can zoom in until you see the microscopic reflections in the bee's eye and consciously decide not to draw them.
It does. And he avoids hyperrealism because it often hijacks the core message of an artwork. If a painting is perfectly hyper-realistic, the viewer's brain stops at the surface layer.
They just think, wow, it looks exactly like a photograph.
Right, they say, look at those technical gymnastics. They admire the sheer mechanical skill, but the underlying emotion is completely lost.
They end up looking at the artist's hands instead of looking at the artist's heart.
That is a perfect way to put it. Duke's ultimate lesson here is that mastery isn't defined by how much intricate detail you can cram into a canvas. Mastery is defined by how much detail you have the courage to omit so that the actual emotion of the piece has the oxygen it needs to survive.
I want to pause on that phrase for a second. The courage to omit. I mean, think about the last big project you worked on, a presentation deck, a report, or even a long email. Our natural instinct is to cram in every single detail, every bullet point, to prove to everyone that we did the work.
Oh, constantly.
But Duke is saying the exact opposite. Stripping things away is where the real power is.
And because he chose to omit so much detail, the specific elements he did choose to leave in are doing a tremendous amount of heavy lifting. The background is a perfect example of this. It isn't a detailed forest. It's a blurred green mosaic.
Yeah, in his curatorial notes, Duke calls this technique visual silence. He achieved it by using low-opacity digital airbrushes.
The mechanics of low-opacity digital brushes are fascinating. Instead of putting down a solid block of color, a low-opacity brush lays down what is essentially a digital sheet of sheer tracing paper.
Oh, interesting.
One layer barely registers, but when the artist sweeps the stylus back and forth dozens of times, those faint layers build up into a dense, edgeless fog. The colors just melt together.
So it's essentially noise cancellation for your eyeballs.
Yes.
By removing all the sharp leaves, twigs, and branches, he prevents the viewer's brain from becoming visually exhausted. If that background were hyper detail, your eyes would be frantically bouncing from a leaf to a feather to a wing.
It would be incredibly tiring. The brain has to process every sharp edge as a distinct object. So by eliminating the edges, Duke gives the viewer's visual cortex a place to rest.
But then, right in the middle of all that soothing visual silence, he drops this incredibly loud, bright red geometric feeder. It functions like a visual traffic cop. It completely halts our wandering eyes and forces us to look exactly where he wants us to.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because that red feeder is a highly calculated psychological anchor. Biologically speaking, red is the very first color the human eye detects.
Really?
Yeah, and there's a deep evolutionary reason for that. Our retinas are packed with cone cells, and the ones sensitive to the long wavelengths of the color red are incredibly abundant. Our ancestors relied on this to immediately spot ripe fruit against a canopy of green leaves, or to detect the danger of blood.
So we're literally hardwired to stop and look at red.
We are hardwired to look at it. Duke refers to this element in his notes as a vital pulse.
So the red isn't just a decorative choice to make the painting pop on a gallery wall.
Not at all. It is a hidden navigational arrow. When you look at Vida, your eye is biologically forced to hit that red geometric base first. From there, the vertical shape of the feeder drives your gaze upward.
Right.
You travel up the vibrant body of the hummingbird until your eyes land precisely on the ultimate point of tension in the entire composition.
The exact point of contact where the bee is resting on the hummingbird's head, he is entirely directing the viewer's navigation.
And once he has perfectly guided our focus to that central interaction using evolutionary biology, we finally uncover the deeper ethical message waiting for us there.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this is where the artwork destroys traditional rules of visual storytelling. In classical art, hierarchy is everything.
Everything.
The bigger the subject or the higher up it is placed on the canvas, the more dominant it is. You know, the king sits on a raised throne above the peasants. The predator stands tall over the fallen prey.
But look at the subjects here. The hummingbird is significantly larger than the bee, but it isn't dominating it. It isn't trying to eat it or intimidate it.
And the bee is positioned physically higher up, literally sitting on the crown of the bird's head. But it isn't acting as a threat either. There's no hierarchy here. There is no boss in this painting.
Exactly. And we also have to consider the intense biological reality of these specific animals. Think about the physical mechanics of a hummingbird.
Oh, they're intense.
They have a heart rate that can exceed 1,000 beats per minute. Their metabolism is so incredibly fast that they are practically always on the brink of starving to death, which is why their wings move so fast they become invisible to the human eye.
They are engines of pure frantic combustion.
And the bee is the universal, timeless symbol of frantic, unending labor. Always buzzing, always working, always defending the hive. So we are looking at two of the most hyperactive, highly strung creatures in the natural world.
Yet in this digital distillation, they are frozen in a moment of absolute pause. Duke describes this specific dynamic in his diaries as the intimate economy of ecosystems.
Yeah, it is an implicit agreement between two vastly different species not to harm one another despite sharing the exact same delicate space.
And portraying absolute peace and stillness like this is actually a much more radical act of rebellion against our conflict-obsessed world than painting chaos. If you want to protest a loud, angry world, yelling back at it just adds more noise to the room.
And I want to be clear that we are impartially reporting what Duke has written in his personal diaries here, but he explicitly frames this intimate economy as a metaphor against global systems of destruction. He observes a world driven by constant war, political domination, and the fracturing of social bonds, and he just refuses to mirror that in his art.
His approach to protest is incredibly subversive. He doesn't paint a visceral, bloody protest piece with dark, aggressive colors to shock the viewer. His protest is a whisper.
What's fascinating here is how the artwork functions as a Trojan horse. He uses these beautiful, vibrant, entirely non-threatening aesthetics, a cute bow with a little bee, soft greens, to completely lower the viewer's psychological defenses.
You let it in because it looks harmless.
You let the image into your mind because it feels safe and beautiful. And once it's inside, it delivers a monumental ethical lesson, which is that the true structural base of the world, the actual thing that sustains life, is delicate interdependence, not brute force.
He sneaks a massive philosophy lesson into a picture of a bird. It's brilliant. You would think, after successfully exhibiting this profound piece in Berlin and achieving that level of narrative control, the artist would be taking a massive victory lap in his diaries.
You really would. But the final section of his notes is actually remarkably vulnerable. He engages in a very harsh autocritique.
Really?
Yeah, he confessed to professional audiences that, despite the success of Vida, he feels he didn't risk nearly enough.
That is wild for an established artist to admit on the record. He actually charts out his future evolution based on where he thinks this painting fell short. He points to two specific areas, starting with space. He says he wants to abstract the background even more.
Because even though the background in Vida is a blurred, soft mosaic, treated with those low opacity brushes, the human brain still reads it literally.
Right. You still look at the green tones and say, okay, that's a blurry forest. I know where we are. It remains tied to literal physical nature.
And he wants to sever that tie entirely. He wants the background to become a purely symbolic emotional atmosphere, completely divorced from any recognizable physical location.
Yes. And his second point of evolution is even more challenging, especially for a digital artist. He wants to simplify the anatomy of the subjects.
Which goes completely against the grain of the technology. You have infinite digital brushes, infinite layers, the ability to zoom in forever, and his ultimate goal is to paint less anatomical detail. I mean, if you paint a perfectly accurate Archilochus colubris, a ruby-throated hummingbird, down to the exact millimeter of every feather, isn't that the ultimate display of artistic skill?
It's a display of technical skill, sure, but it triggers a psychological reaction that Duke desperately wants to avoid. If the rendering is too biologically accurate, the viewer's brain switches into what we can call encyclopedia mode.
Wait, what happens in encyclopedia mode?
You stop looking at the artwork as a philosophical message, and you start categorizing it as scientific data. You look at it like a textbook. Your brain says, ah, yes, the ruby-throated hummingbird, native to North America, characterized by the iridescent gorget. You catalog the facts, but the emotional resonance bounces right off of you.
Oh, wow. The scientific data overwrites the poetry. It's like reading the structural engineering report of a bridge versus actually standing on it and feeling the wind.
Exactly. By simplifying the anatomy, you strip away that distracting biological data. You stop the brain from categorizing, which universalizes the message. Less detail allows the core emotional message to shout louder because the viewer is forced to step in and actively fill in the gaps.
Is there a danger there, though? If you simplify the subjects too much, if you abstract the background until it's just raw shapes, does the artwork risk becoming so vague that the ethical message is lost entirely? Or is trusting your audience to fill in those gaps the ultimate sign of an artist's maturity?
Trusting the audience is the terrifying leap of faith every mature artist eventually has to take. I mean, if you spoon-feed every single detail, you aren't making art anymore. You are lecturing. When you leave space, you are inviting the viewer into a conversation.
So what does this all mean for us? Let's zoom out and look at the whole journey we've unpacked today. We started in a fiercely guarded, quiet studio in Whittier, California, a physical sanctuary pushing back against the frantic noise of the entertainment industry.
Yeah, and we explored the digital distillation process, learning that true mastery is having the courage to edit out the noise so the core emotion survives.
We examine how a red geometric feeder isn't just an arbitrary color choice, but a biological anchor rooted in our evolutionary hardwiring, guiding our psychology exactly where the artist wants it.
And we unpack the profound ethical metaphor of the piece, rejecting classical hierarchies of power to show us the intimate economy of ecosystems, where a hyperactive hummingbird and a frantic bee find a frozen moment of peace.
It is a phenomenal masterclass in visual storytelling, but more importantly, it's a blueprint for how we interact with our own world, which brings us right back to where we started. We talked at the beginning about our cultural obsession with nature as a bloody battlefield, the cheetah and the gazelle, the endless grinding conflict. Because we are so conditioned to expect war, we bring that exact same combative energy into our daily lives.
We really do. We treat our own modern environments like literal battlefields.
Look at your own daily ecosystems right now. Look at the office where you work, look at your social media feeds, or even just the dining table with your extended family. We spend so much of our energy in these frantic, hyperactive flights, just like the hummingbird.
So true.
We are constantly trying to impose our opinions, desperately trying to dominate the discussion, or just frantically trying to survive the sheer volume of noise around us. We are constantly vibrating at 1,000 beats per minute.
Always bracing for the next conflict, you know, always ready to defend our territory.
But Jairo Duke's Vita offers a completely different way forward. It asks a question that I want to leave you with today. What if the most radical, transformative action you can take in your life today isn't to argue louder? What if it isn't to move faster or assert your dominance more aggressively in the room? What if the most powerful thing you can do is find the courage to lower your pulse?
Yeah.
To sit alongside someone else, to recognize their fragility, and to share their space in absolute silence.
A radical, silent coexistence.
The silent truce in a very loud world. Something to think about the next time you feel the overwhelming urge to shout. Until next time.